There we go. Hello. Ta-da.
Oh.
Hello, everybody. It's Tom and Kamal coming to you on the heels of a nice interview with the erudite and inimitable James Tunney. We're going to be talking with the erudite and also inimitable Kamal Southall to
Heavens
maybe
no.
touch on some points in the interview. Background, sort of historical or historiographic in character, because in a sense, the Tunney interview, which was dealing with the net of Scientocracy, while touching on historical developments and considerations, had a sort of theoretical flavor to it. But there were things mentioned in the course of that interview, which with which I was not particularly well acquainted, and I'm assuming that I'm not the only one in that circumstance, such as, for example, the Macy Group, where there are other things too, like the Five Eyes, and so on, and these points of intersection, the X Club, so on, right? These sort of historical organizations, agendas, and so forth. I thought maybe, because Kamal knows more than a little bit about these things, he might help flesh that picture out for us. And then we can always return to a consideration theoretically of what is Scientocracy, what is potentially problematic about Scientocracy, and so on and so forth. So anyway, it's enough of my statements of prologue. Turn over to the autodidact and scholar in his own right, though no doubt he will attempt to resist that characterization, Kamal Southall. So, hello, Kamal.
Hey Tom, it's great to see
Nothing
you again.
as awkward as a
And
comp an unanticipated compliment. So, but
yes,
anyway.
and wholly undeserved compliments. So
Oh,
thank you for the kind
pish,
words. So,
pish posh. So.
it's great to see you again, and great to hear your voice. So yeah, I really enjoyed watching your James Tunney interview. It was very informative and quite fascinating. And may I ask you one quick favor?
Of course.
Is it possible to edit out the next 30 seconds?
Edit out the next 30 seconds.
Yes. We post it. Or is it
I
possible for us to stop the recording and start it again?
yes. Here we go.
I'm sorry. Oh
No,
no, but
you're
then
fine. You're fine.
awesome.
We're back on. You know what it was? We didn't even stop the recording for 10 seconds. He just there was a kitchen consideration. And if I had known that, I wouldn't even have paused the recording because I like to retain the humanity of the interaction as far as possible. That's why I'm eating a piece of pizza. But
I'm
yeah,
sure it's
so,
delicious.
conceptually, Scientocracy, you have the notion of, if you like, handing over decisions that historically have a political character to them to artificial arbitration. And here the artificial is constituted by a body that's sometimes referred to as science. But of course, that term has a nebulous, has an indeterminate quality, which oftentimes leads to its abuse. And in this case, I think would almost structurally lead to that abuse. So much by way of like another sort of theoretical foreshadowing of what we're going to discuss. Parts of those developments can be understood as a consequence of the philosophical climate of modernity, postmodernity, and so forth. But those ideas also motivate and are motivated by people in power, people with names and addresses, as the saying tends to go. And so one space of interest is the Macy Conference. And I don't know much about it, but it's was seen as Mr. Tunney, and I believe you said that you were largely in accord with his understanding as a kind of significant moment in these developments. So maybe you could go from there. Like, what is the Macy Group and so forth?
So, and I was very pleasantly surprised to hear him reference some of these matters. So the Macy Group is kind of an informal, the Macy Group per se is an informal name that some researchers have given to a group of researchers who participated in a set of Macy conferences, right? So the Macy Foundation, the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation, inaugurated a set of conferences back in the 1940s. And they really aimed at doing an interdisciplinary study of subjects related to medicine, broadly speaking, to sort of overcome a lot of the boundaries between the disciplines and some very fancy, you know, gobbledygook that's probably cooked up by a public relations firm. But yeah, essentially the Josiah Macy Foundation wanted to spur innovations in.
Can I ask you, who is Josiah Macy?
Oh, good question. Josiah Macy was a very rich person. And the Josiah Macy Foundation was not founded by Josiah Macy Jr. Rather, it was founded by his daughter, Katie Lund. But Josiah Macy was an interesting 19th century character. He was a very wealthy man, became a philanthropist later in his life, and he was a sea captain, kind of a merchant sea captain. And his fortune was largely made in his nautical enterprises, I guess one would say. And his daughter, after he died, diverted a lot of the family's fortune into establishing a foundation for philanthropic giving to explore questions concerning science and medicine and so on and so forth. So for example, Albert Einstein received money from the Josiah Macy Foundation from a fellowship that was established to benefit Einstein and some other colleagues of his, just as one example. So if you'll excuse me. So the Macy Foundation was established around 1930, and it was established by Captain Josiah Macy's daughter. And it gave a lot of money.
Did she have particular ideological commitments herself, or is that something that happens subsequently?
I suspect she did. But from what little I know of her biography, I would really just be
speculating.
I would be engaging in irresponsible speculation when it comes
to her. So what about the conferences themselves?
So the conferences themselves examine a wide range of topics related to many aspects of healthcare, medicine, pardon me. The conferences, though, that most researchers into the kind of subjects that Mr. Tunney made reference to are mostly concerned with the cybernetics conferences. So it's popularly said, a little inaccurately, that starting in 1942, the Macy Foundation inaugurated a set of conferences to examine cybernetics. That's not exactly true. The famous cybernetic conferences were started in 1946, but they were preceded by a 1942 conference that sort of kind of kicked it off. And this 1942 conference really largely set the tone for what became a very long line of MACI conferences extending into the 1950s. And largely, I think, has a somewhat underrated role in shaping an immense amount of the post-war scientific and social climate. Because out of the MACI conferences, the first one in 1942, not the first conference, but the first one relevant to matters concerning cybernetics, was actually the Cerebral Inhibition Meeting. And the Cerebral Inhibition Meeting was largely established to address two questions. One was hypnosis, and that subject was introduced by the famous and groundbreaking hypnotist Milton Erickson. And I'm not sure if you've come across Erickson or references to Erickson in your readings and study, but Erickson was an innovator in hypnotic technique and a lot of neuro-linguistic programming, NLP. The entire field of NLP was largely based on Erickson's work by individuals who learned from many of Erickson's students and, you know, were seeking initially a sort of therapeutic modality that would overcome a lot of the limitations in psychotherapy and also techniques of, I guess, human cognitive improvement and things of this nature at the time. So these two guys, Bandler and Grinder.
I already have like things to say, but I'm going to hold my tongue for a minute, right? So you said there were
I'm going to a tangent. Yeah, this is a bit of a...
Well, it's not a tangent. The Cerebral Inhibition Meeting, 1946. Okay. First of the...
Well, actually, 1942. Yeah, the Cerebral Inhibition Meeting was in 1942. Sorry.
My apologies. But already you have the hint of the dimension of control. Hypnosis, and what was the other major...
Oh, you'll love this. Conditioned reflex.
Okay. So we're in a still behaviorist milieu where behaviorism was the ascendant, dominant, so-called scientific model with reference to how to interact with human beings. Consistent with the foci being innovating hypnosis on the one hand and seeing how reflexively conditioning. What was it again? How did you put it?
A condition reflex and hypnosis.
Reflexivity and hypnosis for the two. So right at the outset, even before we get into what we termed cybernetics per se, you have an interest in the development of techniques that are essentially directed to the manipulation of human activity.
Yes. And the individuals invited for the first conference are also interesting in their own right. So one is Margaret Mead, the famous anthropologist, and her husband, Gregory Bateson. And Gregory Bateson is a fairly interesting individual. He's indirectly connected or implicated with the rather torturous MK Ultra, quote unquote, research that the CIA conducted in the 1950s and 60s. And were finally spanked, and the auspices of the church committee told to knock that naughty torturing people with psychedelic drugs and other things to do whatever they claimed to be doing. But Bateson claimed, and other people in his defense claimed, that he wasn't knowingly connected with that, but there is evidence that has come to light in one of his papers and the papers of other scholars associated with the field, like quote unquote Jolly West, psychologist or psychiatrist. And it definitely seems highly probable and likely that Bateson was knowingly associated with, which is again a tangent, but knowingly associated with MKUltra, or at least, if not knowingly, excuse me, my phone, this time it fits, was his research and skills and talents were being used by individuals
totally in the service of Central Intelligence Agency that was interested in using psychoactive drugs to manipulate behavior and possibly scale that project to a population tier or strata. Right. For those who are not familiar with MKUltra, that accurate characterization of the program?
I think that's fairly accurate. I mean, that's what the Wikipedia page would largely indicate, although
by the way, it's an incredibly muted, understated characterization that the kind of bilious and diabolical things that were done under its auspices exceed what I could have relayed here.
Yes.
Just to go on the record as being unequivocally condemning of MKUltra. But
and unfortunately, much of the paperwork was shredded too.
Get all drawn off. And it isn't that strand of the net. So if you'll forgive me to come back, 42, you've got this conference, cerebral inhibition itself, kind of an instructive
name. Right, cerebral inhibition. they weren't exactly subtle.
We're
the cerebral inhibition meeting.
You inhibit their cerebral activity. Anyway.
There's other people, Frank Beach and Carl Binger, I can never pronounce his name, but it was a fairly small working group of psychologists and psychiatrists. And the work that was done in that meeting sort of set the ground for the later full-scale cybernetic conferences, which were inaugurated in 1946. They ran between 1946 and 1953. And they include a far wider roster of researchers. And the famous mathematician, and you could call him founding father of artificial intelligence in a certain sense, Turing himself was associated with this group. And I think if I was reading Tunning's discourse correctly, I think he was drawing the line between the research and people like Alan Turing and the mathematicians who largely developed a lot of his ideas after his death, and the theme of control of human consciousness and human cognition that was explored, among other things, in these conferences. So yeah, it's fairly fascinating. And Turing himself, while he had a connection with the individuals who largely constituted these group of Macy Foundation organized researchers, he himself being British, other than, he was largely also connected with something called the, if I recall correctly, the Racial Club. Did the two of you discuss the Racial Club during your interview? I'm trying to recall. Came up.
I don't think that particular, if it came up, it came up under a different moniker.
Okay. But he did mention the X Club, which was very, it was fascinating that he mentioned that. So the racial.
There are two other groups that are interested in the X Club. I'm also interested in the elaboration of the what are the five eyes to which he refers. But to sort of recapitulate what to ask a question rather, right? So you have then like the from this outset 42 and 46, there's a shift to the cybernetics or the notion of, you know, cybernetics. It's interesting that Turing is a significant mind there because Turing contributes to a lot of the theoretical foundations of what is understood by computing and so forth, as you already said, but he's interfacing with a whole consortium of individuals. The only thing I wanted to sort of inflect about that connection is you have a model of human beings, which is fundamentally mechanistic. You see that already that at the outset, you have the endorsement of reflexive conditioning and a particular spin on hypnosis. I thought it sort of amusing that you said trying to deal with the limits of psychotherapy. I was amused by that remark because I don't know if that's actually fair to psychotherapy. Or at least certain kinds of psychotherapy, which provide a context in which the patient can come to a new and kind of radical freedom. Whereas hypnosis, while it can be used in a liberating manner, oftentimes has a contrary effect, or so is my impression. With that being said, I was going to ask you, how did they constitute, or how would they describe the cybernetic? What did they mean by the cybernetic?
The actual conference, I'm sorry, pardon me, go ahead.
No, that's fine, go on.
Oh, so there are a set of papers and a body of research that came out of the MACI conferences, and I will not I would not remotely want to pretend that I've waded through any of that material to any depth. My interest in the MACI conferences, my personal interest largely came as a result of my interest in some of the individuals who were involved and my interest in kind of the formation of cybernetics, the conceptualization of cybernetics, and notions of creating a kind of command and control structures and things of this nature, and the evolution of ideas concerning mechanical brains, electronic brains, hence computer technology as we have it today, and how that came out of earlier, perhaps naive conceptualizations of human neurology, and more of just kind of the archaeology of ideas. That's something that was of great interest to me. But my understanding of the goal of the MACI Foundation's cybernetic conferences was, broadly speaking, they aimed at constructing a vast interdisciplinary kind of general broad science of the human mind itself. What makes the human mind work? What makes it tick? How do humans take in and process information? How do humans derive meaning from information? What are the behavioral patterns of the human mind? And so on and so forth. So these were some of the broadly discussed aims of the conferences was largely aimed at that. particular line. And they also, like, they I don't remember the whole range of conferences that the Macy Foundation kicked off, but the cybernetics conferences were only one series out of many. Some were devoted to a number of other medical problems. So
what is it,
like, reaction to stimulus? Like, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Like, I was going to ask for an example of a medical problem that they examined,
quote unquote. Phantom limb syndrome. So phantom limb syndrome, which was obviously of some concern after the war, given the massive disablement of many people, amputations, and the like. So the whole, what phantom limb syndrome was and how it could be addressed and what the implications of phantom limb syndrome.
So that is like a fascinating example that you raise, because on the one hand, you have a group of people who are involved in a highly reductionist approach to human being, right? And of course, they're not like a homogenous group. These are different individuals. But then you have the examination of the phenomenon of phantom limb syndrome. And what that actually brought to my mind is the work of Rupert Sheldrake, who is often considered to be associated with the exploration of paranormal phenomena. And he did a lot of experimentation around phantom limb syndrome. Wow. Experiments, for example, where he would have someone sort of on one side of a wall or a door with an amputee or whatnot. Where a lot of times, what's interesting is that even people who are congenitally bereft of an arm or leg will still feel as if they have a presence there. Okay, so they put the arm through the door, the phantom limb, as it were, and then there is a person on the other side who, you know, maybe establishes having a certain sensitivity, and the tests they indicate the degree to which other people can actually encounter the phantom limb independently. It's interesting stuff, and it intersects, as I said, a broader range of phenomena, which are sometimes deemed quote unquote paranormal. I think it's interesting that these people were focusing on these kinds of things as well. And part of it is that not all of them, I'm sure some of them were well intended, but I also am inclined to advert that there are motivations at hand which are less than benign. The Russians did a lot more with that stuff, I think, than we did. But
possibly.
It's just an interesting example that you proffer. So
it is. And also, just to make sure that make it clear in my connection with Turing, I don't believe that Turing himself actually physically attended the Macy conferences. But in his connection with the Racial Club in England, Turing was, you could view him, this is my understanding, and if anyone watching this finds this incorrect, I would love to read corrections in the comments for your video. But my understanding is that Turing was sort of connected with him in a sort of a Republic of Letters type of sense through individuals within his network. And in the UK, the Racial Club was largely as an informal working group, both in communication with and aiming at the same type of work as the group of individuals connected to the MACI Foundation cybernetics conferences. And actually, on Turing's end, a lot of this work led to...
What is the racial? What was the racial club? If you could, because we're starting to run against the time a little bit.
The racial club was a rather interesting group of intellectuals in the UK. They were formed in the late 1950s, and Alan Turing was a very central member within that group, to my understanding. And they're kind of a dining club. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Is it fair to infer from their sobriquet that they were involved in broadly eugenic speculation?
No, this would be racial, spelled R-A-T-I-O. They were more involved in mathematics.
Ratio, right, or ratio. The ratio, not racial. Okay, I got you. Sorry, I misheard you.
Sorry for not clearly enunciating.
The ratio. But, yes. So they're probably sort of similar to the Vienna Circle, right? There are a bunch of American sort of analytic style thinkers taken up with certain problems originated by people like Frege and so forth. Russell, I imagine Bertrand Russell flirted with them. I wouldn't be surprised if,
I thought Russell was fairly, I could be completely mistaken. I thought Russell was actually more than flirted with him. It was some.
Well, I don't know. I'm just guessing.
Not deeply involved, but
Right. But in any event, you have this sort of motif or these sets of motifs that are very bullish on the capacity of what you might refer to as rationality, but specific type of rationality, namely a rationality that wanted to emphasize the mathematical and the logical as the categories of cognition which had the which were most promising as paradigms of understanding. So you have people like Frege who were trying to reduce language to a formally logical system and so on. And certainly Russell and Albert North Whitehead and their Principia Mathematica attempting a certain thing, which was then submarined by Kurt Gödel. But the reason it's important to bring these people up in connection, I imagine, with the MACI Club is because, or the MACI conferences, is because the latter likely derived a sort of smug confidence from their conviction that their attachment to mathematical reasoning vis-a-vis people in the Ratio Club and similar organizations grounded the legitimacy of their own efforts, which I take to be broadly circling around control and psychological control and medical control.
Yes.
Is that about the sum of it?
I think that's fair.
What you find interesting is the set of personalities which inhabit these groups. So there's a group, and we
can initially.
Right. That's what sort of drew you to them.
Yeah, and the personalities and their role in molding 20th century and now 21st century culture and society.
Political decisionality.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. And
I'm guessing they played an especial role in the British Empire.
Yes, but also a role in the, for in I guess what we would we could call the American Empire as well. Because we're looking at an Anglo, and this is where the Five Eyes group becomes very interesting decades after this.
What are the Five Eyes?
Yes. So the Five Eyes, it's a rather amusing, it's one of these intelligence spook puns. They are most definitely punsters, possessed of some humor. So the Five Eyes represent the five predominant Anglophone, I mean, it's basically the Anglosphere, excluding poor India, because I think India and Pakistan both rightfully are members of the Anglosphere, as well as a few former African colonies, Jamaica, probably Trinidad, and a few Singapore. Other places in the West Indies. But from the from the prospect of the global north, the most powerful entities of the global north, I guess everyone else, they don't count. But Australia, the former colonies and dominions, because let it not be forgotten that Canada, I believe, technically is still a dominion of Great Britain, even though it's also an independent country. Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the United Kingdom itself, United Kingdom of England, Scotland, and Northern Ireland, and the United States of America, and Wales. Oh, God. I hope the Welsh forgive me for. Well, you see, just out of honor, I'm sure the Welsh would like to be left out of it. So.
Right. Well, they'd all be left out of it, except for the English. Okay. All right. So I probably should let sleeping dogs lie as far as all that goes. But
yeah, it's basically everyone with the Queen Mum's face on their currency, with the exception of we Yanks. We get George Washington shoved in our bills. But America is the primary, So these are the people whose spooky eyes are peering into everyone else's business. So the Five Eyes is an intelligence alliance. And it was allusion was made to it in the second to the last, penultimate James Bond flick, the Daniel Craig one, Spectre.
I think that's the
yes, you're right.
Not to be pedantic.
No, please be pedantic.
Of course, it's hard. It's hard not to be pedantic when you're using a word like antipenultimate.
But it's the consortium. Well, a fictional version of the consortium was a plot point. Inspector, if I recall correctly, basically the evil organization Spectre, this octopus whose arms were, well, tentacles were all over the world, were using, that's sort of the great eminence behind the scenes collectively, the United Kingdom to consolidate all the intelligence agencies of the civilized world into this vast intelligence sharing network to keep everyone safe in an age of omnipresent terror or terrorism or both. That fictional consortium was an echo of the real Five Eyes Alliance, which was largely established by the UK-USA agreement, with the UK-USA treaty. And it was initially set up to share signals intelligence, tap overseas cables, satellite transmissions, do interceptions of mobile phone traffic and things of that nature. And as the internet grew, it largely grew into intelligence collection across the internet. And it's the kind of stuff that Edward Snowden largely leaked a lot of information about. WikiLeaks has discussed, has published a lot of leaked information about it. John Young, the New York-based architect who has run Krypton, which preceded WikiLeaks as a sort of intelligence leak, I guess you could say,
clearinghouse.
So yeah, like a central, like an online clearinghouse of leaked intelligence community information.
So let me ask you by way of clarification, right? So the five eyes, you obviously have in any one of these polities numerous so-called intelligence groups. So like, you know, we have the CIA and the NSA and they've got the MI5 and so on and so forth, right? But the I is not actually associated strictly with any one of these agencies, right? The idea is that behind these agencies, there are other.
Top people.
We're putting it with top people.
Top men.
Indiana Jones or whatnot. Yes. But the Ark of the Covenant is in a warehouse somewhere in Toledo. I don't know.
Yeah. That magnetic crystal skull was just a little.
So the reason that's actually like an important point, right? Not the Indiana Jones thing, right? But that you're not actually dealing with like, there's like, this is where you get into some very, I think, interesting historical connections, which aren't even controversial, but which just shows like, the idea is that intelligence agencies are ancillary, derivative, secondary to the business of the nation state. But when you look at phenomena such as you're discussing here, where you have conferences like the Macy conferences, essentially a philanthropic effort, alliance with things like the Ratio Group, and then they ultimately are under, you know, are working in tandem with intelligence organs themselves, part of a sort of nested layer of people who are difficult to track down, then you would sort of run into some very interesting material. In terms of like global, in terms of geopolitics, like when you start looking at who is actually inhabiting these agencies, this is where the personality point is. The CIA, initially, as I understand it, was staffed by not a trivial amount of former Nazis. Okay, that we appropriated these Nazis after the World War II, and they came over and. They were used to staff the CIA, which is connected with other. So to what extent under this veneer of like the five eyes, is there really even national difference? I mean, I know I'm like sort of jumping ahead to like a big, bigger sort of set of questions that I really had intended to access in this interview, right? But do you think that that trajectory to which I'm pointing is one that should be pursued?
Personally. Yeah, I mean, I have no answers, but as far as my personal beliefs and what I glean from the literature I've read, I think there are some difficult questions, and it's difficult to avoid sliding into what might contemptuously be termed conspiratorial thinking or conspiracy theorizing, although. Conspiracies are fairly banal. You know, you go to your average middle school and you will find every middle school classroom chock full of conspiracies. And it's just what humans do. People often intrigue together in collusion to accomplish ends that they would rather often keep secret from their schoolmates or, the other clique of mean girls who sit on the other side of the high school cafeteria, or, you know, this other group in the office. I mean, it's, this is what people do, and this is imminently what governments do in organizations representing institutionalized, centralized capital, and institutions of governance, like, and criminals, in which may include sometimes people in official standing, or at least in non-official standing as well, but with some degree of massive social and political agency. It's said that behind every great fortune is a great crime. I don't know if that's true, but it certainly sounds like a spiffy saying, and it rolls out easily on the tongue. But I think one could definitely say that behind every great nation, state, are a set of great crimes. And conspiracy is legally defined as more than one individual working, I mean, secretly in collusion with each other to accomplish criminal ends, which they would rather remain secret. I mean, there's U.S. code definitions.
Definition. I mean, no, yes. Central intelligence. Well, anyway,
if you make the laws, then maybe it's not technically conspiracy of a criminal nature. So if you make intrigue, collusion,
they're criminal. They do criminal things all the time, every day, right now, today. Who knows how many? Not just the CIA, the NSA. I mean, their business is the business of deception and control. That's their business. And it's hard to be involved in deception and control and not be involved in, if not outright evil, something which is criminal in nature.
And I personally like to, when I look at the actions of people with whom I vehemently disagree or who I find problematic, I think it's important to have some real empathy. And I'm not just being tongue-in-cheek. I mean, it's...
Everyone's a person. So you have to distinguish between, you know, someone works for the CIA. Yeah, I'm sure they're a person too. Okay.
And you have people who sincerely believe... Well, I think you have a lot of very cynical people. I can't imagine having certain jobs and not being a profoundly cynical human being. But at the same time, you know, people, they have jobs, and their job is to either protect the country or the nation state or the government, or protect its interest, you know, the nation as a corporate body, to protect its interest from their enemies. And heavy, you know, cliche time, heavy is the head, the worst the crown. I mean, it's...
So this is actually
anti-authoritarian. I don't like centralized power. Yeah, I don't like crowns.
Crowns might be useful in dentistry, but elsewhere I think not. And
even still, there's some holistic dentists who find crowns to be a little problematic as well.
Well, I'd be probably sympathetic with that view. But what's interesting about this line is that it actually draws a circle back to Scientocracy and how people can be perhaps drawn initially in a good faith fashion into projects that are bad faith in nature. And there's various ways that one can sort of direct the manner of completing this circle.
Yeah. I think
on the more cynical side,
ideological capture, right? I cut you off. No, it's okay.
I'm just going to suggest that, you know, you talk about defending a society against its enemies. It begs a question of who are the enemies. And then the issue becomes whether this particular set of ideologies that seem to be present in elite circles lead to defining the enemy as the people who constitute the country. And then this translates into control and deception and surveillance and all the rest of it in order to keep them from undermining the state which they inhabit. I imagine that is the perverse, is perverse, the perverse rationality of people who serve these projects, but it's all in the name of science, or a particular understanding of science.
Difficult. I mean, to be fair, are some particular understandings of science, because there might be a few competing ones at work at the highest levels, but
Well, you could say it's scientistic or scientism as opposed to science per se, if you want to retain the purity of the word science as connected with a specific methodology, which, while potent, is yet limited in its epistemic capacity.
I think scientism is very much an appropriate theme to address when looking at these sort of historical intellectual projects. So I think there are hegemonic ideologies that sometimes capture groups of people, groups of intellectuals, groups of thinkers, policymakers, scientists, cryptocrats, intelligence officers. And I mean, it would be easy for me to just say, okay, not just condemn people as deluded, but as like willingly self-deceptive. But at the same time, you know, some could say, well, you don't see the data, you don't see the threats that we see every day coming in, and you have no idea what we save the general population from. Churchill once made reference to the rough hands who protect the king. I'm going to butcher that quote. Actually, I'm not even going to try. But basically, the idea is that you have some fairly rough individuals whose efforts enable we soft civilians to sleep well at night.
And, I mean, it brings to mind a few like tropes, right, in popular presentation. I remember the episode of like True Detective, for example. There's like a moment of sorts between the two detectives played by Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson, and I can't remember the exact line, but it's the effect that we are awful men, but we are here to stop other even more awful men. Or you can go to like A Few Good Men, the movie, Tom Cruise, Jack Nicholson, and Jack Nicholson, you know, talks about that you can't handle the truth, right? And it would be disingenuous of me to pretend that perspective is entirely without merit. However, I think when it comes down to constituting what is it going to be a human being, be a human society, it's not ultimately acceptable. What's ultimately necessary is for all of us collectively to confront the realities of the world and not admit to this notion that there are those of us who need to be protected because we're too gentle.
Patronizing.
What that does, that's actually a form of condescension. You're saying that some people can't handle it. And I'm saying that, no, actually, though, how you go about disclosing these realities of people varies contextually. Ultimately, we all have a resource in terms of soul and spirit to rise and address the challenges of the world. And the ultimate challenge, of course, is a problem of human evil. That's like the, you know, the elephant in the room.
Much evil in the world is done by men who are seeking nothing but good, and who are not only convinced that, you know, this whole sort of kind of reductive recourse to the idea of a greater good. Maybe there's some truth to many things are contextual, right? So just to use a metaphor, a surgeon may wrought great violence upon a body, slicing, cutting in, removing entire organs, spilling blood all over the operating room theater, and, you know, just surgery is a very violent, invasive act. But it's often a necessary act when it's not just being done to increase like billables to insurance companies, and, you know, to pad out a surgeon's 401k, right? That's me being cynical, but this does happen. There's a good deal of unnecessary surgery. Well, there's a good deal of unnecessary medical procedures of any nature that are done, but that doesn't invalidate the utility and usefulness and necessity of the same medical treatment, the same surgery, or the same procedure when done for the right reason on the right individual. Sometimes, unfortunately, you have to cut off someone's arm if it's riddled with gangrene. Sometimes you have to cut into a chest and operate on a lung. And yeah, I'm butchering this, no pun intended, I'm butchering this metaphor. But I think it's kind of apropos here. Yes, one could take the perspective of being a monster to some degree morally, but being a monster to fight greater monsters. I think one of the tragedies of human history, and it's one of these things that are very rarely observable to the people on the ground at the time, is the degree to which a lot of mutual human monstrosity is simply not only not needed, but can just be not evaded, just transcendent, bypass. Like, there are a lot of things that aren't necessary, but the logic, the limited logic of the participants in a historical action, some warlike nature, let's say, some violent action, some heinous act that we would see as criminal, to the people wrapped up within the logic of the conflict or the interaction, they may not be able to see viable options outside of the monstrous acts of violence that they are engaged in.
They're trapped within a situation.
Yes, they're trapped within a situation. And often...
Well, we should wrap it up here. I'm sorry to be somewhat abrupt in bringing it to an agenda, because certainly it's not an end, right?
But yeah, I'm sorry for diving down rabbit holes.
No. And you hardly, it's not that you haven't gone down, everything is relevant. The problem is that it's sprawling, so you have to make decisions. But to draw around, right, you know, like, what you have is a failure of imagination. And I think there's also like the exigency of trust. Like, ultimately the way forward is to trust people whom you don't know. And yes, it shouldn't be as difficult as it is.
But it can be very difficult in low trust societies or low trust situations. And
oh yeah, that's
this is where ideology. Yeah, it's like if you are captured by a sort of hegemonic ideology that has a very reductive, almost game theory like, dare I say, sociopathic way of viewing human conflicts. And if it's like, okay, they are most definitely going to screw me within, you know, maybe a 98% degree of confidence, right? They're going to screw me over somehow. And maybe 2 degrees, maybe 2% degree of confidence that they won't.
You can see well, it just reminds me of this anecdote about, you know, the early days of game theory at the Rand Corporation, which I thought was incredibly instructive.
We're connected to all of this in a very sprawling way. But
and was it John Nash, those guys who came up with it, right? But then not Nash personally, but these other people thought that it would be interesting to see about the application of game theory to human interaction. So they said, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to set our secretaries against each other. And, you know, they did all this sort of calculation and figured it. We say this to Judy and so on and so forth. And it completely backfired. They tried it on multiple occasions. And every time what happened was the secretaries, instead of then descending into some kind of ridiculous internecine office theater politic, okay, they ended up communicating with each other and coming to a solution vis-a-vis consensus or whatnot, right? And it just completely undermined or just demonstrated right at the outset as to how game theory, as it's born, doesn't understand human beings because it has this thing, which might be, I think, like a nice point upon which to sort of tie it up here. But let me leave it to you to have the closing word.
Oh, I think that's a brilliant point. I think it points out the almost, I don't want to choose my words carefully, but I think there's a very inhuman way in which many of our contemporary society, well, globally across the board, but particularly within the Anglosphere, not limited to it, but the Five Eyes countries, which largely monopolize global power and are at the top of the world's pecking order. Many of the people in charge to some degree, the sort of policy-making elites, higher level political elites, you know, the people who largely articulate on an official and unofficial level, policy, right, and law. These people, many of them, have a way of viewing human nature that's kind of disconnected from real lived human realities and lived human experiences. And dare I say, there's something somewhat inhuman here, which I think interestingly connects to the whole cybernetics project in trying to understand the human mind as a set of feedback mechanisms, like steering ships, steermanship, looking at circular feedback loops and feedback mechanisms and control mechanisms. And yes, this understanding of cybernetics has influenced the development of modern computing technology, which is capable of amazing things. I mean, like what we're communicating on, but at the same time, is based on an idea of the human mind, the human brain, human neurology, that you know, while may be a useful model or set of models at a certain level, leaves out vast spheres of lived human experience. And I think there's a certain kind of empathy deficit here that you sometimes see visibly come across in the communication of individuals from these sorts of strata society. And it's beyond very problematic. Like if you can't wrap your mind around the fact that in the normal lived reality of human beings, we have ways of resolving conflict, communicating with each other, empathizing with each other, to kind of overcome this sort of like, well, I'm going to screw him before he screws me, kind of dynamic. That's a very impoverished view of human reality. And it's useful for building like supercomputers. All right. Yeah. But it's not useful to understand vast swaths of lived human experience, to just keep repeating myself endlessly. And I think that anecdote that you shared points at a lot of what people find very problematic about these sorts of working groups like the X Club, which we didn't go into, which produced brilliant thought and brilliant thinkers. The, I will not say racial club anymore. You know, the Macy conferences.
Right, it's a ratio club.
Well, it should be ratio or.
Well, colloquially, ratio. I mean, you can say ratio too. I don't know. It's probably a tomato tomato situation. This is as long as you have the umlaut, the invisible umlaut, ratio. Yeah. Then it doesn't sound like right anyway. So, ratio ratio. Anyway, whatever.
Whatever, but yeah, if you explore some of these,
so
interconnected clubs,
like the X Club and so forth. Yeah. I just unfortunately the space and time press upon me, and so I'm afraid we have to sort of leave it for the moment. But thank you, Kamal. It's always impressive, like your command of these things, like who you know the who's who and all that sort of thing. And I, even though we didn't probably get into as much minutia as may have been desired by some, I think it was a very useful introduction. So thank you for that.
It was fun. It was very enjoyable. So
we'll be back. We'll be back with more. So down the line, I hope so.
Same here.
Any other closing thoughts?
It was a pleasure. I would say at the risk of being terribly cliched and silly, just love each other. Let's just be humans and let's not try to control each other.
Right on. All right. Groovy. Well, that app note, we're out for now. And thank you guys all for listening. Thank you, Kamal. Talk to you later on.
Thank you, Tom.
Ciao.
Ciao. All right.